Welcome to the 54th edition of Amici, the podcast of the New York State Unified Court System. Today our guest is the Honorable Raja Rajeswari, a criminal court judge in New York City and the first Indian American and South Asian woman judge in New York State history. Judge Rajeswari came to the United States from Chennai, India, when she was only 16 years old. After graduating from Brooklyn Law School, Judge Rajeswari spent 16 years working in the Richmond County District Attorney's Office, four of them as Deputy Chief of the Special Victims Unit. In 2015, she was sworn in as a criminal court judge in New York City. Among her other activities, which include performing classical dances at Indian events and temples and the Padmalaya Dance Academy, Judge Rajeswari co-chairs the Court System's Advisory Committee on Language Access. She is fluent in four languages.
Judge, thank you for joining us today. If we could, let's start at the beginning. Just tell me, if you would, about your early years in India. Tell me about your family and your living conditions and how it came to be that you wanted to emigrate to the United States as a teenager.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I was born in southern India, in Chennai, and it was just me, my mom and dad. I'm an only child, and my mother was a dance instructor, and my father was an office clerk. And my mother had made it her life's mission to bring art to every person in her community. She was a dance teacher, and as a child, I would accompany my mom to go to various different locations all over Chennai in southern India to perform Indian classical dance. At first, when I was a child, I didn't realize, you know, what that meant to some of the people who we went to perform. I just figured, you know, it's entertainment, it's good. As I got older, I realized she had brought art to children who had no access to any entertainment or any kind of cultural activity, because in India, in the 70s, there was a big caste system, so certain high-level castes were not allowed to mix and communicate with the low caste people who had lived in the slums in India. But my mom had specifically made it her life's mission to bring art to every child in that community. So I was very fortunate. I started performing since I was 3 years old and started teaching when I was 10, Indian classical dance, and I ended up traveling all over India with my mom to bring art to children who would never otherwise have the opportunity to see dancing. So we were in a rich family. In fact, we lived in a one-room house, which was a small 10-by-10 room, which served as our living room, dining room, bedroom, entertainment space, if you will. But my parents had filled that house with so much love and art, and they taught me to try to make every child's life a little better. Even if they didn't have any money, you can volunteer, you can go and provide services to people to try to make their lives a little bit better. And I started doing community service since I was a child.
Now that interest in dance and art, I know, continues to this day in this country. I know you're still performing at Indian events and temples and the like.
Yes, not myself anymore. My daughter, who I named after my mom, is now the person who's teaching and performing under my guidance and direction. But as I stated, bringing art to these children who live in the slums brought so much joy to these children because they weren't allowed to go to regular school, so they had no type of art or music or any kind of relief from their everyday life. And this was a venue for them to be creative and channel their creative dreams. And some of them that my mother used to teach when they were young now run their own dance schools in India, in Chennai, and they've contacted me now after several years.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, I was very proud to see that. They are now influencers in their own community, and they are actually spreading more art to other children who are in need.
Now, why do you think art is important to the education and development of a child?
Art, I think, is very important because it gives you another creative outlet. You know, the children, if they can afford to go to school, they're able to attend an expensive school in India. But if you are born in the slums and you have very little education, you have to get by with whatever the government is providing. It doesn't give you any other creative outlet. Art will let you sing, read, write poetry, paint, you know, any type of art that can express someone's creativity, can actually show them that they are able to dream and hopefully one day achieve it. It gives them self-confidence. It gives them a break from the reality of their very difficult life, and it helps them aspire to things.
Now, why did you want to come over here?
Well, as a child, I was aware of, especially in southern India, I witnessed flagrant gender discrimination, which was actually built into the fabric of society. A lot of my friends, my female friends who were very, very bright in school, at the age of 14 and 15, every time we would go to summer vacation and come back to school, I would see one or two of them were missing. And when I inquired, they said, oh, their parents figured they were better off getting married rather than wasting money on education on a girl. At least that was the mentality at that point. So that foreclosed their opportunity to obtain higher education. I was also privy to hundreds of abortions in India because the baby they were carrying was a female. And the prevailing thought was that this female child would prove to be an impossible financial burden to the parents when they got married. And as I grew up, I also realized there was a lot of cases of sexual abuse. And since the victim was from a low caste or from a poor family, they refrained from making a complaint to the police because they knew they would be ignored due to their gender, caste, and social standing. So this made a real impact on me. As my mother traveled to perform, you know, not only in India but to the other nearing regions, and I traveled with her, and I realized one of the most important things we need is equal rights. At least women need a chance at education, a chance at making their mark. And, you know, always you've heard America was the land of opportunity. So that's something that I've always wanted to do. And I was selected in 1988 to travel to Guyana, Suriname, and Trinidad, which are celebrating 150 years of Indian migration. So I had traveled with my mom and my dance troupe with then Vice President Mr. Shankar Dayal Sharma. I performed for a crowd of over 55,000 people. So it was an amazing experience for a teenager. And the last performance of that itinerary was in New York. So when I came to New York to finish the performance at 16, I saw the Statue of Liberty for the first time, and I actually shed tears when I saw the opportunity, or at least the belief that this is the land of opportunity where you can have equal rights. The fact that you are a female child doesn't automatically become a burden to your parents. So I wanted to continue my education in a country that afforded women equal opportunities to pursue their studies, and women are considered a vital part of the workforce here. So that's when I decided I needed to stay here and try to get an education and make my mark if I was given the opportunity.
Now, you indicated that America was viewed as a land of opportunity. When you got here, is that what you found?
It is the land of opportunity, but, you know, as people describe, you know, there is no gold and honey and milk running in the streets. It is attainable. Every dream is attainable, but you need to work very hard. And as an immigrant, there are more challenges you face than somebody who's obviously born here because of your lack of contacts, your lack of resources. But I did find that there were a lot of people in the South Asian community who helped me, assisted me as a young teenager who was here. If you are willing to work hard for your dreams, no matter how many times you fail or how many obstacles are there, if you are steadfast in your belief you can succeed, this country will give you that opportunity to do it, but you have to do the hard work.
Now, I don't imagine at 16 you knew you wanted to be a lawyer, or did you?
No, I didn't, but I always knew, because I told you, growing up in India the way I did, the way women were treated had always made an impact upon me since I was a young child. So I wanted to always stand up for people like the rape victims or the young children who could never stand up for themselves. But at 16, I didn't know what that venue would be. That's just something, you know, that was percolating in my thought process since I was a teenager. And as I got older and went to college, I realized being a lawyer would be that vehicle for me to serve as much as I could.
Hmm. And then when you were in law school, did you know what kind of law you wanted to practice other
yes.
than working for the people you just mentioned?
Yes. When I was in law school, I knew I wasn't interested in any kind of contracts or corporate law. I found that it's probably lucrative, but I found that boring.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew if I wanted to study law, I wanted it to be in a field where it has real impact. Criminal justice and criminal law always drew me in because probably I grew up in a country where there was not much justice, and most of the people weren't able to avail themselves of the court system. So my respect and reverence for our criminal justice system here begins with its foundation that the rights of every defendant are the rights that belong to all of us. Those rights are sacrosanct and should never be trespassed upon. Because in India, based upon your caste or your social standing, you are not even allowed to make a complaint. And the complaints weren't taken seriously. So while our criminal justice system here is not perfect, you know, there can be so many improvements, it is still one of the best systems in the world, having witnessed other countries and other systems where so many people have no rights at all. There are a lot of rights we take for granted here, but those are the rights that I cherish, and I wanted to make sure that everybody has those rights when they are here. So I always wanted to do criminal justice. I interned in the DA's office when I was in my second year in law school. Then I clerked for a judge when I was in my third year in law school. And straight out of law school, it was an obvious career choice for me to join. I wanted to do public service. I never wanted to be somebody who just had a lot of cases that meant nothing to them. So I joined the DA's office. As I stated, our criminal justice system is still one of the best. It affords every person, regardless of their sex, race, color, sexual orientation, or social standing, an opportunity to seek justice. It's not perfect, but, you know, we can work on it and provide it. If you come from another country, you realize that most of those people don't even have the option to go to court. Those options are not even offered to them. That's why it was important for me as an immigrant to learn the system and then hopefully try to help other people who are here in the same position as I am.
Now, as a prosecutor in a large county, you've had an awful lot of cases and an awful lot of high-profile cases. I don't know if any of them are more high-profile than the Carlos Rosario case. Can you tell me a little bit about that? I think he was the first person convicted under the predatory sexual assault law. Is that correct?
Correct. He was the first person charged in the county, in Richmond County's history. We've never charged that case. And so I became a prosecutor. I worked a lot of different types of cases. And as I kept trying cases and I got promoted, I became the Deputy Bureau Chief of Sex Crimes Special Victims, DV Bureau. They were all combined in Richmond County. It's a small bureau. And those were the cases that meant the most to me because that provided me an opportunity to provide a voice for women and children who are unable to speak for themselves, because a lot of my complainants were from Southeast Asia and Africa and South America and Latin countries, where there is a lot of cultural stigma in accusing somebody's boyfriend or husband or significant other of domestic violence. So many of them, I don't think, expected somebody like me to be in the DA's office. One lady actually turned around and said, I didn't want to come here. I knew nobody would understand me. Nobody would speak my language. But then I saw you, and you not only spoke the language, you understand the culture. So I figured this has got to be some sort of divine intervention that you are here in Richmond County this day. This woman was from Pakistan. One of the things that I took great pride in was to be able to communicate with these different victims and speak to them in their language, understand their culture, and hopefully help them get the resources and the supports they need in New York. And there are a lot of resources, but they're unfortunately unaware of them. So due to my position in that bureau, I was able to reach out to a lot of victims. But the Carlos Rosario case was probably the most difficult case that I've ever prosecuted because it involved so many young children. As I started investigating that case from one teenage child, the investigation just ballooned into doing a search warrant of the defendant's location and retrieving hundreds of different CDs and discs where he had recorded multiple events events of him raping the children and videotaped them, which was horrific. And then we learned that many of these children were 5 or 6 or 7 years old, and he was like the neighborhood uncle, if you will. This gentleman was in his late 50s, very pleasant, very sweet. He would approach all the single moms who worked late night shifts to provide for their children. Most of them were from, as I stated, South America or East African countries. They were single moms, and he would befriend them and get their trust and offer to babysit the children when the women were working. He would always have candy with him, so, you know, children were attracted to him. Unfortunately, he was doing horrific acts to these young children. And he was videotaping them. We got a hold of his diary, his videotapes, and he had destroyed most of them. Someone must have tipped him the police were coming, but just from what we recovered, we were able to charge him with over 160 counts of child rape and sexual abuse of children.
In my experience with sexual predators, the one thing they all seem to have in common is they are extraordinarily and devilishly resourceful.
Yes, they are. And this gentleman had only moved to Staten Island a few years ago. He lived upstate, and he was in his late 50s. So I don't think he started out in his 50s. He's been doing this for years. Unfortunately, he had never gotten caught. So one of the most challenging things in that case was for me to view the actual videos, which were horrific to see, but we had to catalog them, right? See how many victims, how many counts, how many dates. So we did a second superseding indictment on him, and I was able to reach out to the moms of these children and get them counseling services, get the children services. What we found out years later was he had moved from the neighborhood, but he had still kept in touch with the children. And some of them were now teenagers. You know, he was molesting them for so many years, and unfortunately they trusted him, so they didn't actually say anything to their mother. And when the moms found out, they started blaming themselves, you know, because they're working, they're providing, that they weren't there. But you're absolutely right. He was charming. He was resourceful. They all trusted and believed him. He violated that trust in the most unimaginable way. And Mr. Rosario also was HIV positive.
Oh, no.
So one of the most dreadful things I had to do was to have the children tested. This was years later, but, you know, we didn't know if he had passed on through sexual activity any of these children were infected. Thank God they were not.
That's remarkable.
They were all okay. And one of the reasons I took a plea on that case, because I wanted to try the case. However, for me to try that case would have involved traumatizing the children all over again. They would have to look at the videotapes. They'd have to relive this. And that is incredibly hard. I mean, you know, he took several years. However, there was no amount of time that was going to be justifiable for what he had done to so many children for so many years.
Unfortunately, and getting back to their resourcefulness, sexual predators know that prosecutors don't want to put the children through that sort of trauma and use it to their advantage, I know.
They do, but in this case, I was ready.
You sure were.
I was, because this was one defendant who needs to stay away from children, because as I stated, he's only in his 50s. I have no idea how many neighborhoods and how many children he had victimized over these years. And reading his journal, if you will, and looking at all the videotapes and the photographs and the mementos that he had kept, told me that, you know, I believe in everybody redeeming themselves, but there are some people who are just not redeemable, because the children were 5 and 6 and 7 years old.
I sure wouldn't trust them out in the loose. Now, I know that you lost your mother just a couple years after you arrived here, and your father not that long after.
Right.
And I have some vague recollection that becoming a judge at the time when you had what seems like an extremely successful and very, very fulfilling career as a prosecutor was fulfilling a promise you made to your father. Is that correct?
Yes. My mother, actually, I came in when I was 16. She had passed away. And again, we were on our way to do a charity performance. I told you, my mom, you know, bequeathed her love for community service and helping people. So she had agreed to do a charity dance performance in Canada with me and our troupe. We were on our way there. when, you know, we got into a very bad motor vehicle accident and she had passed away. I was alone. I had actually broken my leg a little bit. My back was completely out of alignment, and I didn't know if I could walk or move or dance at any point. And I had lost my mother, who was my teacher and my best friend. So that was a little challenging, I would say, at 18 to be broken and broke in a new country.
I'll say. So you were on the same motorcycle?
No, this was a motor vehicle, yeah.
Oh, motor vehicle, okay.
Yeah. So I was alone, and I had lost my mother, and I said to myself, what am I going to do now? All my dreams of coming here to do this, that was the only reason my mom came here, to help me get an education. I said, if I go back, then all this was for nothing, all her sacrifices and everything she had done. So with the help of the South Asian community, you know, you do what you have to do. If you have to do 2-3 jobs, I went on scholarship to the College of Staten Island, which I was very grateful for, to City University, and then decided to go to law school. I was fortunate to get a partial scholarship to Brooklyn Law as well. So that was one reason I didn't give up when my mom passed away. My dad had passed away just a few years ago. He was alive. He was with me, and he was my comfort and my guide throughout this journey. He had lost his battle to cancer in 2014, and he was in India. He felt more comfortable with his treatment there. And the last conversation we had, he said, you need to put in your papers as a judge. And I said to him, Dad, I can't think about this. They're telling me you're not doing well with the chemo, you know, you're in the ER. I said, I'm going to get on a plane and I'm going to get there, but promise you'll be okay. And he was a very smart man. He said, I don't know what God has in store for me, so I can't promise you that. But I do know what you need to do. You need to put in your papers because you need to become a judge and tell your story. Of course, I'm thinking, you know, I can't think about this. My father's dying. This is so much more important. So my father said, promise me you'll do this no matter what happens. So, of course, I promised my father. I got on a plane. By the time it took the 36 hours and 3 different plane rides for me to get there, he had passed away. So that was the last conversation I had. And after a year, you know, we have a traditional mourning for a year, and I said to myself, I've never broken a promise to my father as long as he was alive, so I'm not going to break one now. And I said, I don't have any shot. I'm not political. I don't know anybody. All I've done is my work, which is very important to me. So let me put in my papers to fulfill my promise to my dad, and, you know, and I'll continue being a prosecutor because it was very fulfilling. And I have to say, whether it's my dad watching over me, I was just very fortunate, and I got a call within a couple of months. And I'm very grateful to the mayor for giving me this opportunity to do this, because I'm told I'm the first South Asian and the first Indian female judge to be appointed to criminal court in New York City.
How did you position yourself even to be noticed by the mayor? There must have been hundreds of people looking for a judgeship.
Yes, everybody was. And when he had asked me, I told him my story of, you know, what it meant to me to have this opportunity to go to school. One of the things he had asked me was, what do you want to do when you're a judge? Obviously, you know, everybody says you need to do justice. In fact, the first person who gave me my job, the late great district attorney, Mr. William Murphy, who was my idol, had said, my job and my challenge as a prosecutor was not to win or lose cases, but to do justice in every case. His words have always stayed with me. And I said, you know, everybody talks about doing justice. Everybody talks about helping people. So they had asked me, what would you do specifically if you became a judge? I said, I would want to make the court system, the environment, more user-friendly for our immigrants who come here. That was one of the things I wrote in my application, that I want to provide better access to justice. When I got here, I had so many people assist me, but I spoke English fluently. And growing up in India, the way I did, I spoke multiple languages. I'm multilingual. I can read and write several languages, which is great. But if I didn't speak English when I got here, that would have been a real detriment. But there are thousands of people who come here where English is not their first language. And just like everybody helped me, I wanted to help them. And I said, I want to improve language access. So I was very fortunate to have Judge Marks give me the opportunity to do this. the first thing I said when I got appointed was, can I be in the committee? Mm-hmm. And I thought everybody was just going to turn around and start laughing and said, who are you? You've been a judge for what, 2 minutes? Mm-hmm. What do you know about language access? But they weren't. They actually were so gracious and gave me an opportunity to become a member of the advisory committee. And now, after a year and a half, Judge Marks has given me this incredible opportunity to be the co-chair of this Language Access Committee, and I've made it my mission to provide language access to immigrants from every part of the world, regardless of the country they come from, to try to get them access to justice, because that is my way of paying back, of giving back to this country and this community that's given me so much opportunity to do it.
Now, I know the court system has a stable of somewhere around 300 interpreters employed by the courts, and I think we retain another 700 or so on a per diem basis. And I think we provide interpreting services in something like 100 different languages.
It's 119 languages.
119 languages.
Yes.
Are we doing enough?
There is always more that we need to do. That's why I've been very fortunate to work with dedicated people in the advisory committee. We had Mr. Brett Schneider, Ms. Fern Scher, who are amazing co-chairs, with Judge Juanita Bing-Newton, who is the dean and an amazing resource and a role model. And working with them, we realized the more we need to do is in recruiting and training and providing a better network. As you stated, we do have 300-plus staff interpreters and 700-plus per diem interpreters, but the need in New York City, as you can imagine, is just exponentially growing. And the need is also different in different regions. For instance, the top spoken languages in the Bronx is not the same as in Oneida County or in Monroe County. So we have to take that into account as well and keep up with the need of what the language interpreter needs are. We have about 5 million people in New York who speak a language other than English, and 2 million people are not fluent in English in New York City.
Wow.
As astounding as that statistic is, we are actually now promoting the new action plan, which we're very proud of. A lot of people have worked on it way before I joined the committee, and they had released the action plan in March of this year.
Mm-hmm.
And as a part of my responsibilities in the committee, I've actually presented the action plan at the New York City Bar, and I've also presented that at the Judicial Institute this summer. And I just went to the JI in October to present it to different chief court clerks. So my goal is to bring the different varied partners in our court system together to help them understand this need and what resources we have. So the action plan is an amazing product that our chief judge wants us to promote. And one of the steps in that is how we meet the need is training. So I'm doing a training on all these different areas with different people like court attorneys and managers and judges and court clerks. And I'm going to do a presentation for legal aid because I want them to know the options we have. In addition, we're going to do recruitment. Usually about 500 people take the exam for the language interpreter. Last year, over 910 people sat for the exam. So we've nearly doubled the amount of people. We've gotten in touch with so many different cultural organizations. I've myself called over 100 different organizations that I know, you know, due to my community ties, due to my dancing, and spread the word that we are looking for so many different languages from Southeast Asia, from South Africa, from South America, from all different regions of the world. And there are people who are fluent and who can become per diem interpreters. It pays them a good per diem salary. They're also able to help their community and their fellow members who are here by not making them wait. Because to me, justice should be equal for everybody. So if somebody's from Sri Lanka and that Sri Lankan interpreter has gone on vacation, is not back for 2 months, that person's case has to keep getting adjourned. But if we have, let's say, 5 different interpreters in that language, we are able to provide better access to justice for that particular immigrant. And that's what I want to do. I want to increase the number of interpreters want, that's why I'm doing recruitment with all these different organizations. Our advisory committee is a very dedicated group of people. And we are trying to spread the word. We are also trying to have the exam now be twice a year, not once a year. And also we are hoping to give it online so more people can easily take the exam, because the exam is very difficult. We want also quality. We just don't want to increase our network. We also want to make sure the highest quality is maintained through rigorous testing and continued training. Because as you can imagine, in a criminal case, right, mistranslating or something is lost in translation, that could seriously affect the outcome of a case and also...
Fatally, sure.
Also, you know, violate somebody's rights as if they don't actually understand exactly what they are pleading to. So it's a very strict standard. So we want to not just double the amount of people who take the exam, we also want to keep quality control. So we have another exam coming up actually in January. The deadline is December 1st. And I've reached out to several different bar associations like the South Asian Bar, Asian American Bar, Richmond County Bar, and the Women's Bar, as well as Legal Aid, to promote this exam among, you know, their various different members. And I've reached out to several cultural organizations across New York State that I'm familiar with. And you'll be amazed at how many people will actually look at this and say, you know what, I speak those languages fluently and I can read and write them. Maybe not a staff interpreter, but I can do it as a per diem. That's what we're hoping to do, is attract more people to take the exam and get better quality.
I imagine it's much more complicated than simply being fluent in more than one language, though.
Absolutely. What the interpreters do is amazing. They do... they can do, you know, site translation, they can translate documents, but they're doing simultaneous translation in the courts. So imagine in a busy court like my courtroom where there's a lot of cases, a lot of people, a lot of movement, and you still have to correctly interpret what the judge is saying or what the attorneys are saying to the client in that language and do it at the simultaneous pace. So that is part of my training for the judges as well, to take a little bit more time on the interpreter cases, because those cases are the ones that need a little more attention to make sure the interpretation is done right and the defendant's rights are not violated. And, you know, everybody gets equal access to justice.
If someone wants to pursue a career as an interpreter or be it a per diem interpreter, how should they proceed?
They can go to the website. I actually have it. I can email it to you, courtinterpreter@newyorkcourts.gov. Mm-hmm. There is a website, and the website will actually give them information on, you know, the upcoming exam, as I stated, in January. The deadline is December 1st. We're going to offer one later in the summer next year in June. And it will give them sample questions and how to register as well. And it'll give them step-by-step instructions on how to take the exam.
Well, that's great. Well, I think we're about out of time. So I just want to thank you for sharing that inspiring story with us. That was really fascinating.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
Thank you, Judge Rajaswari, and thanks to our audience. Over the past couple of years, we have produced more than 50 podcasts with a wide variety of guests and on a wide variety of topics. All of our podcasts are on the Office of Court Administration website at www.nycourts.gov, and many of them can also be found in the iTunes podcast library, thanks to a collaboration with the Historical Society of the New York Courts. If you have a suggestion for an Amici podcast, please contact me, John Carr, at 518-453-8669, or send me a note at jcaher@nycourts.gov. In the meantime, stay tuned.